Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an apparent buyer's remorse amongst Middle East leaders for their prior support of ISIS, with the Saudi king in his Ramadan message denouncing the religious extremists now threatening Iraq and Jordan, vowing, "We will not allow a handful of terrorists using Islam for personal aims to terrify Muslims or undermine our country." Ori Baki, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, who served on the United States State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss blowback in the region as reports emerge that ISIS crucified 8 rival fighters from the moderate Syrian opposition, to whom President Obama recently pledged $500 million in aid. Then we will speak with the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Soglin, who, along with 7 other mayors from 8 states, sponsored a resolution adopted by the U.S. Council of Mayors at their recent annual meeting to endorse a return of post office banking as a $1 trillion job-creating economic stimulus and revenue generator. We will discuss the mayor's move to allow the U.S. Postal Service to offer banking services to the 68 million Americans with limited or no access to basic financial services, who often fall prey to predatory payday lenders charging exorbitant interest rates that extract $89 billion in interest and fees from low-income Americans. Then finally, Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, who gave Crimea to Ukraine, joins us to discuss her latest book, just out, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. With EU leaders spending hours on the phone today with Ukraine's leader Poroshenko and Russia's President Putin, who continues to destabilize Ukraine while avoiding increased EU sanctions, we will look into the cycles of repression and reform in recent Russian history, from Stalin's terror to Khrushchev's thaw to Brezhnev's re-Stalinization to Gorbachev's reforms to Putin's renewed repression. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And what do you make of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia's Ramadan message, where he criticized religious extremists, clearly talking about ISIS, saying that their goal is to sow discord amongst Muslims and that we will not allow a handful of terrorists using Islam for personal aims to terrify Muslims or undermine our country and its inhabitants. We are continuing with God's help to face and tackle this scourge. Isn't this the same regime that's been sort of quietly supporting these very same people, along with the Turkish government?
Well, along with many other governments in the region. That said, I mean, ISIS is really a monster that has been created by years and years of violence in the Middle East, where many, many regimes have helped their own proxies, their own supporters to do all this. And suddenly the Saudis are realizing that ISIS is now so powerful, so big, that it threatens their own interests. And unfortunately, there is, of course, in the Saudi response today, a great deal of, probably regret for what they've done, but also, I mean, one needs to be a little bit cynical because they are responsible for the rise of such extremist groups. This Saudi policy of supporting all kinds of fundamentalist movements, not just in Iraq and Syria, but throughout the region and even in Central Asia and elsewhere, is well known, and the Saudis have created a monster. And, you know, we shouldn't just say the Saudis. The Qataris, in their own way and their own proxies, every government has contributed. And in a way, you can even go back and say, look, all of this violence that was sanctified, you can say, or certainly condoned by many regimes and many groups of people in the region, especially when it was directed against Westerners, against Israelis, etc., and is now coming back to haunt them. Because once you unleash this kind of violence and you justify it, it's bound to come back and have this blowback effect and bite you. And unfortunately, this is what is happening. And clearly, the Saudis are sufficiently alarmed that they are warning now, because there are some reports say that as many as 2,500 Saudis now fighting with ISIS, not to mention people from other nationalities. And we are seeing some of this going to come back, just as in with the Taliban and in Afghanistan, to come back and haunt all of these regimes.
And, of course, it was a Saudi suicide bomber who recently blew up a building in Beirut, which indicates how vulnerable Beirut is and how much this whole ISIS or ISIL can spread, given that ISIL means the Levant, which includes Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Jordan.
Right, and I mean, in Lebanon, actually, I think it's particularly poignant because it is Hezbollah who really started the suicide bombing stuff, and now suddenly Hezbollah and Hezbollah's population is being targeted by suicide bombers. It was okay when they were doing against others. Now it's coming back to haunt them again, and this is what happens when unfortunately you unleash forces that you cannot control or contain.
And of course now ISIS doesn't even need Saudi or the backing of independent money from the sheikdoms and various wealthy individuals, because they've stole something like $500 million from banks in Mosul.
Right. We don't exactly know how many. I mean, I've seen the highest figure I saw was $400 million, but still that's an enormous amount of money. And clearly with that kind of money, they will be able to buy not only the arms they need in addition to the ones they've captured, but most importantly, they'll be able to buy people. And a lot of these ISIS fighters, while quite good at what they do, also get a lot of money. I mean, the story is that they get about $400 a month, which in that part of the world is actually quite a lot of money. And we're also seeing that ISIS is trying to build a social service network in order to get the population to support it. So all this money, of course, is going to help them do all these things. Look, I think ISIS in the end in Iraq doesn't have a very good future, in the sense that the Iraqi government, I think, will eventually come back slowly, not quickly. I mean, they're already trying to get back to Crete from ISIS. It's not clear how successful they are, but eventually they will be successful, because the Iraqi army is still a disciplined army. Now with the American advisors coming in, the tactics will get better. So I'm not necessarily worried, in the sense that I don't think Iraq is going to fall prey to ISIS. They're not going to be able to take back that. However, a great deal of those arms that they captured in Mosul and elsewhere have already been transferred to Syria. And that's where I do believe the balance of power will shift in favor of ISIS and away from the Free Syrian Army and its supporters. And the danger will be that we will end up with in the medium term, a fight between the Assad regime and ISIS, and it's really pocks on both of the houses. And so that's why I think there's going to be a significant strategic change.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. So ISIS just crucified 8 rebel fighters in Aleppo, in the town square. They nailed them up there. They accused them of being Sawa, moderates controlled by Western powers and others, the Free Syrian Army. How much do you think fratricide, I mean, if we're going to be giving $500 million, as President Obama pledged, to the so-called moderates, whoever they are, what are the chances of a response to ISIS from other fighters, both in Syria from the so-called moderate opposition and in Iraq itself from the Sunni tribal fighters who apparently have joined with ISIS in an alliance of convenience against the Maliki government?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, I think, as I tried to indicate earlier, the balance in Syria is probably going to move in favor of ISIS. But in Iraq, it's not just the president's $500 million initiative, but also I think that if there is a new government in Iraq that does not include Maliki as prime minister, that we may see a shift among the Sunni tribes. Maliki has unfortunately done a great deal of damage to Iraq in the sense of he has really embittered the Sunnis, many of whom have not accepted the fact that they had lost power in Iraq, and some of them still believe that they are the majority when obviously they're not. But nonetheless, he went out of his way to undermine all those networks that had been created to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so it's only if Maliki is removed that we will, that $500 million will be of significance. And that's how the hope is, that they will change the alliance structure. All those tribes that you rightly mentioned and said they have now an alliance of convenience with ISIS or ISIL will eventually shift, because they will, you can buy them off. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but in the end, most of these tribes were with the Iraqi government when they were fighting al-Qaeda, but it was not under Maliki. And unfortunately, Maliki has been a disaster for Iraq. And if you were to not lead the next government, that we will probably see much greater success, obviously, and they'll be able to shift the allegiances of not all of the tribes, but probably most of the tribes.
Well, just in the last few minutes, Henri Barki, it would seem, though, that Jordan is the most vulnerable, given that it's now sharing its border with Syria, on its border with Syria and on its border with Iraq. Essentially, it's facing ISIS on both sides. Secretary of State Kerry was there. He was there Friday, as well as Saudi Arabia, which may well explain the Saudi king's recent statement. The other player, of course, that you're very familiar with, Turkey. How much buyer's remorse are they having, since they really did predict the very quick downfall of the Assad, which didn't happen, and apparently have in many ways funded and nurtured ISIS?
Well, I wouldn't say that they funded and nurtured ISIS. I mean, I think that would be incorrect. They were probably closer to al-Nusra than once they gave up on the Free Syrian Army and the moderate opposition, because they decided that they were hapless and could not get the job done. That means overthrow Assad, to which the Turkish Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, had committed himself to. So that's when the shift occurred in terms of support for al-Nusra. ISIS is a little bit different. I am not exactly sure whether they actually helped ISIS. What they did do, however, and you still, despite Turkish statements to the contrary, people are crossing the border from Turkey. Jihadists are coming still through Turkey. I had a friend of mine, a French colleague, who was just in the border area, and he told me the other day 2 days ago, he said, look, the border is still easy to cross for the jihadists. Every plane that flies south from Istanbul has a number of jihadists on board. They're still crossing. That's where the Turks have been very important in terms of becoming essentially a conduit for these jihadists. But once, you know, these, you don't know, it's not as if when these jihadists cross the border, the Turks will not ask them, are you al-Nusra or ISIS or some other group? You know, please check the appropriate box. So I'm not sure there's been a direct relationship between the Turkish government or the Turkish intelligence or the cutouts. I mean, the Turks use one of their NGOs, and an NGO goes by the name of IHH, to help these people cross the border and sometimes even give them arms. But I think it's mostly for Jabhat al-Nusra and not ISIS. And yes, I mean, I'm sure the Turks have buyer's remorse, but they also are probably saying, look, we are in this position because the United States and the West did not mount a more rigorous campaign against Assad, and the longer the anti-Assad fight continued, of course, the greater was the chances of radicalization. I mean, that said, the regional countries also have not done anything to help the moderate opposition in a significant way, and they haven't banded together, they haven't thought strategically this through, and they've turned essentially hoping that the United States will do it for them. Anyway, so yes, there is some buyer's remorse. I'm not sure how much of a buyer's remorse, but because clearly jihadists are still coming through Turkey. Maybe there's no direct support militarily anymore. But look, ISIS suddenly, I mean, here's an important thing to realize is that one of the reasons that the Saudis now are concerned about ISIS is not just the 2,500 Saudis fighting for them, for ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but also Jordan. I mean, I think Jordan is very, very critical to the Saudis, and Jordan is the next target in many ways for all these jihadists because it's the low-hanging fruit in their view, and therefore, and if Jordan were to go, then the whole of the Saudi border, northern border, is completely exposed. So Jordan,
not to mention Israel.
Right. I mean, but you see, the Israelis are much better at defending themselves than the Saudis.
Well, Henri, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I appreciate your joining us, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalizations, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back speaking with the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Soglin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Soglin, who is the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. He was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student, and he also was very active in that city's anti-war protests, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Soglin served three terms as a city mayor starting in 1973 and another three terms in the 1990s, and he taught in the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Soglin.
Thanks. It's great to be with you again.
And the Council of Mayors, the National Council of the U.S. Council of Mayors, had their recent annual meeting, which just ended a week or so ago. And you, along with seven other mayors from eight states, sponsored a resolution endorsing a return to post office banking as a $1 trillion job creating economic stimulus and a revenue generator. And of course, you are joining the ranks of people like Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who've been calling for this at a federal level. Clearly, the United States Post Office, USPS, is a federal agency. So what kind of influence do you think you can have?
I'm not sure. This is not the first time we've entered this world of financial services. A number of years ago, when there was an assault on the credit unions, the Conference of Mayors also adopted a resolution, and we worked to preserve the integrity of credit unions, and we're continuing to do so recently, particularly the ability of credit unions to make small business loans, and that's been successful. So perhaps in some small way, we can deal with a problem that's been growing now for close to two decades.
Well, the USPS, of course, is in a unique position in as much as during the Bush administration, the Congress passed this draconian law forcing the Postal Service to prepay 75 years of pensions, which is the main cause of why they are in such financial straits, along with the fact that, of course, that they're competing with UPS and with Federal Express. But most of the impetus seems to be, from Congress at least, to privatize the post office further. Senator Feinstein's husband has been given an exclusive contract to sell off the valuable properties of the U.S. Postal Service, some of which are treasures from the WPA days. And they're even talking about setting up booths in Walmart. So your proposal really needs some legs, doesn't it, Mayor Soglin?
Well, let's go back to the role of infrastructure and the role of the role of government in trying to create economic equity in this country. When you look at certain kinds of governmental functions or those regulated by government, we know that services would not be provided to the least affordable areas of the nation. Without the U.S. Postal Service, there would not have been deliveries to rural and remote parts of the United States for the same price that you could send a letter across town. And there's an economic and a equitable underpinning to all of this. It's the same reason, by the way, that we try to get regulations that ensure electrical service, that we try to get telephone service, whether it be wired 100 and some years ago or wireless today. It's why we're fighting to cross that digital divide. All of this is very fundamental to the growth of this nation. And if it hadn't been for this kind of philosophy, vast areas of the South and the Southwest of the United States never would have been in a viable position for people to make a living. It's that simple. The other part of the discussion about privatization is the false notion, the basic assumption that the private sector can provide it better and cheaper. The private sector picks and chooses where it goes, and it doesn't go into these unprofitable marketplaces. Now, when it comes to financial services, it's very interesting. You know, the original premise of making loans available, the original premise was that it either goes into an asset that's going to grow in value or it's going to go into an asset that's going to contribute to economic development. It may be an asset that's depreciable, or it may be something as ephemeral as education. But when we look at today's economy, particularly in the last 20 years, since the Reagan and the Bush years, there is tremendous profits to be made in loaning money in an unproductive manner. To step in between two parties and to contribute nothing of value. When we look at the advertisements that we see, whether it's for automobiles or it's for furniture and appliance, what is really being sold? It's not the item itself. It's the notion that you are going to borrow money and be heavily penalized, especially when you can't finish making the payments at zero interest at the end of the first year. What are pawn shops all about? The new modern pawn shop is not the pawn shop of 100 years ago. The new modern pawn shop is in the business of getting you to come in to buy furniture at outrageous interest rates.
Well, I, in my opening, Mayor Soglin, I mentioned that there are 68 million Americans with limited or no access to basic financial services who often fall prey to predatory payday lenders charging exorbitant interest rates that extract $89 billion in interest and fees from low-income Americans. And, you know, they are so these payday lenders are so predatory that Holly Petraeus, the wife of General Petraeus, managed to get through a law passed that forced payday lenders to, you know, put a buffer zone between them and military bases because they were preying on our men and women in the armed services.
And the Petraeuses are not a bunch of sandal wearing liberals walking the beaches of Santa Monica.
No. So
I spared a few adjectives.
Mayor Soglin, what do you think is that? Because remember that the postal service used to offer banking services, along with buying fishing licenses and all kinds of things that rural America uses. And, you know, in these tiny little towns across rural America, in many ways, the post office is still the center of public life. It's where people meet, they get their mail, etc. They're already an existing infrastructure, and they did have banking up until the 1960s when the banking lobby put them out of business. So, what do you think it's going to take, apart from yourselves and Senator Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren?
Well, I'm hoping, and this is the way most of these changes come about, that we get significant populations of people in congressional districts who start making it very clear to their representatives that this is something critical for the lives and the success of families in the community. Unfortunately, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's fortunate, but when groups of mayors, for example, go to representatives in Congress, whether it's the House or the Senate, we've got a limited audience, and we're taken seriously as maybe a threat in some ways, but outside of working for block grant money and transportation funding, on these other kinds of issues, we're not as effective as I wish we could be. So we're just one more voice in this discussion, and hoping to add to a larger discussion about the nature of private and public enterprises and all of the myths and basically lies. And what happens in this nation is that when you do have a public enterprise that's successful, or if it meets competition, what the privatizers do is handcuff it, and you've already described some of the things that were done to the Postal Service, to make sure that self-fulfilling prophecy of failure comes about.
Well, another example of that, Mayor Soglin, is that the other area where we're slipping behind the rest of the world, even though the internet was created here in the United States, is in high-speed broadband, where in countries like...
Don't get me started.
Well, I wanted to give the example of...
All right, but let's talk about that, because this was another resolution, another topic which we discussed at the mayor's conference. And what it has to do is this. In 19 or 20 states now, the capitalists, AT&T, Time Warner, Comcast, and the rest of them, went into the state legislatures and persuaded them to force municipalities to shed their role as a franchisor, claiming that this was free enterprise and would create more competition. Well, what happened? What happened is exactly what you'd expect. They carved up territories. They are not providing service into low-income areas.
So because the example I was going to give was the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, that has high-speed broadband. It's the fastest in the world. I mean, in the United States, they've somehow managed to keep it going. The city of Santa Monica.
They're in the center of the motherland. The People's Republic of Chattanooga is blazing a new trail. I mean, they're doing marvelous stuff there. They are attracting business.
Well, so is the city of Santa Monica, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So is the city of Santa Monica. They put in high-speed broadband, and it's a huge boon to attract high-tech Silicon Valley-type businesses and startups.
Exactly. But there are about 20 states, including Wisconsin, where in the mid part of the last decade, around 2005 to 2008, AT&T and its comrades marched through the legislatures and got legislation to prohibit any kind of municipal regulation or municipal participation.
So you're pretty much hamstrung there in Wisconsin?
We had a very viable local system. We had to shed ourselves of our relationship to our franchisee, and now we're stuck. We cannot get high-speed internet. We can't get extension. We have a system called Muffin here in Madison. We can't expand Muffin, and we can't provide either access that is needed by tech companies that demand the high speed, or cross the digital divide and get quality internet service into low-income neighborhoods.
And did Governor Scott Walker have anything to do with this decision?
Actually, this was part of the pillaging of Wisconsin that took place before he became governor. And let me point out that a number of prominent Democrats in both houses of the legislature, panting for campaign contributions, contributed to this folly.
So this is systemic and endemic, then. This is really about big corporations creating...
It's about money and politics.
Money and politics. But also, isn't it an affront to the very notion of free enterprise and capitalism, that these big, powerful corporations essentially use government to enable themselves to become monopolies, to kill
that's
off competition?
Exactly correct.
Right.
Yes, that's exactly correct. What they are now doing is using the phrases of capitalism and free enterprise to, in effect, create monopolies, stifle competition, make it more difficult for new entry into the marketplace. And interestingly enough, and this is critical to it, to understanding it, they would share an existing marketplace with one of their competitors. They would do that so they don't have to risk making investments and opening new frontiers in a more competitive marketplace.
Which explains why Comcast wants to buy Time Warner.
Comcast wants to buy Time Warner. Charter sits on the sidelines complaining that it wasn't invited to the dance. But as long as its position's protected, it's not going to say too much.
Well, Mayor Soglin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you, Paul. Again, I've been speaking with Paul Soglund, who is the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. He was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student. He also was very active in that city's anti-war protests, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Soglund served three terms as the city's mayor starting in 1973 and another three terms in the 1990s, and he taught in the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined by Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, and we'll be talking about her new book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind.
With love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. Her latest book just out is The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And she has an article at Reuters, Putin's Face-Off, Make Schwarzenegger Our Man in Moscow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you very much.
And Russian President Putin and Ukraine's leader Poroshenko spent hours on the phone today with EU leaders, the French and the German leader in particular, discussing how to defuse the situation in Ukraine. But it's a bit surreal given that it's Vladimir Putin who continues to destabilize Ukraine while avoiding increased EU sanctions. How long do you think that Putin can get away with playing both the arsonist and the fire brigade?
Well, he seems to be getting away with it. I mean, he's been getting away with it for quite some time now because it's almost, at least in his presentation, and it does seem to be almost accepted by everybody because he's not called on that it is a Ukrainian problem. They keep asking, he keeps asking, his foreign ministry is asking for the Ukrainian president Poroshenko now talk directly to the rebels in the east, and the Kremlin is saying that they have some influence but not necessarily the great influence and whatnot. So it does seem that he's increasingly acting as a peacekeeper rather than the instigator of the conflict. I think the conversation today was about what's happening tomorrow, whether it's going to de-escalate and whether the new sanctions are going to be imposed on Russia or Russia could escape and avoid that.
So you were just in Russia a few days ago. Is the mood of euphoria over Putin's seizing of Crimea and supposedly taking on the fascists in Ukraine, are people still giddy with a sense of pride at what's going on?
Well, they seem to be somewhat giddy or continue to be giddy about Crimea because that has been a sore point for Russia since certainly 1991, when Ukraine became an independent country and Crimea, by default, became a part of a foreign country, because, of course, until 91, Crimea was part of the Soviet Union, whether within Ukraine Republic or the Russian Republic. So, yes, they do continue to be happy about this, but it wasn't really too much of a giddiness about anything else, and the Russians necessarily do not support the other destabilization in Ukraine. And I have to say, I was slightly stunned by the forcefulness of the Kremlin propaganda on the Russian TV, because they do know that the minute they stop forcing that whole fascist rhetoric in Kiev, and you know the fact that there's new fascists in Kiev and whatnot, Russians very quickly turn away from TV and will start think about Ukraine the way they always thought about Ukraine, that it is the Slavic brother of Russia. So it is more of a TV propaganda that, and Crimea that now keeps the balance in the Putin favor rather than the other way around, but not necessarily too much of a Ukrainian crisis, because Russians do want the crisis to end. And they really don't want the war, certainly, and they don't want to appear as an aggressor, at least in stronger terms than they already have to.
So what's your sense then of whether or not there will be a deal here? I mean, my understanding was that Putin did not want Ukraine to sign this EU deal, which they've just done. Is he prepared to live with, to your mind, Nina Khrushcheva?
Well, Ukraine did sign a deal, and one would say, you know, the West won versus Russia, but there've been 400, if not more, people actually killed over this, which is a lot of people. First of all, and Ukraine really is just now destabilized for years to come, because East Ukraine needs to be pacified. They need to be convinced that, in fact, those in Kyiv are not their enemies, that Ukrainians and Russians can live together. So it's not that Putin lost. It's just, it appears that it is in a kind of balance, sort of zero-sum column, but not necessarily, because Ukraine still needs to prove that it can be part of Europe. And Putin can be very influential to stand in their way of making them prove that.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. Her latest book just out is The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And she has an article at Reuters, Putin's Face-Off, Make Schwarzenegger Our Man in Moscow. Nina, I want to talk to you about your book, which I've very, very much enjoyed. I read so much nonfiction. I have to do these interviews every day. But it was wonderful to read this family memoir and to get this feeling of Russia through the experience of your extraordinary family. But let's just briefly touch on your somewhat sardonic suggestion that Obama should appoint Arnold Schwarzenegger to be U.S.'s next ambassador to Moscow.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words about the book. Well, I'm just trying to find a solution that is not ideological, because the United States does seem to enjoy to sort of stick Putin in the eye with, not that he doesn't deserve it, but I think diplomatically it's really not, these are not good moves, because Putin doesn't respond to threats, Putin doesn't respond to scolding. And every time then the United States acts as a superior power, that only really exasperates the situation rather than fixes it. And since Putin is well known as a admirer of culture, but sort of, I would say, kulturka, kind of a pop cult, but not even pop culture, sort of the gala performances, the celebrity culture rather than the real one. And, his relationship with Steven Seagal or Gerard Depardieu are well known, so I'm suggesting that perhaps Schwarzenegger, who also has very serious credentials, in fact, in your state, California, or somewhat serious credentials as a governor of California, could become the next ambassador, because this two men who admire bodybuilding and body showing off and all these other things, both have trouble with women, with their wives. Putin is divorced, Schwarzenegger separated, and whatnot. They can both speak German. So they have a lot in common, and that, I believe, could improve diplomatic relationship with Russia.
Well, I hope President Obama is listening to this conversation and takes your advice, Nina Khrushcheva. Let's turn to your new book, The Lost Khrushchev, a family journey, into the gulag of the Russian mind. The book starts out with you as a sort of teenager meeting the famous Molotov, who, of course, is famous for the Molotov cocktail, but more infamous for, in effect, giving permission to Hitler to start World War II with the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, which then led eventually to the invasion of Poland by both Russia and Nazi Germany and the beginning of World War II. What's so extraordinary about this, your story, is, which is largely about your search for your grandfather, even though you are the great granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, Khrushchev in fact was your grandfather, because your real grandfather Leonid, who was Khrushchev's oldest son, was a fighter pilot in World War II and disappeared in 1943. But what Molotov says offhandedly to you is, "Oh yeah, your grandfather, of course, was a spy for the fascists," which is a horrible, horrible canard and calumny to say to a war hero. But then he says, "Oh, but of course that was rubbish," you know. But that Stalinist slander of your grandfather continues to this day under Putin, where you have Yazov, the former defense minister, saying the same thing in his book. So what is it about Russia that, and it reminds me of the propaganda against Ukraine, that this idea that you could, slander and a genuine hero as a fascist. What is the mechanism there? Why does it have traction in Russia?
Well, and I think it's a fantastic question, just because we're talking about Crimea and how, as I said, on TV it's being propagated as we are the saviors of those poor Russians in East Ukraine that people in Kyiv allegedly want to Nazicize. I mean, there is not a word like that, but something like that. Russia is a very, because the state in Russia is more important than individual life, than heroism, than anything. And so whatever serves the state becomes the state story, becomes a propaganda story, and Russians are very susceptible to propaganda precisely because they just genetically believe that the state is more important than the individual. So, and Leonid, because Khrushchev is a persona non grata and has been not the most favorite leader in the USSR for years and years, because he was ousted in 1964. He was not mentioned until Mikhail Gorbachev started his Glasnost and Perestroika in the late 80s. And under Putin, of course, because Stalin and World War II were such big, big achievements of the Soviet Union, and because Putin, although he didn't say that publicly or didn't say that in so many words, certainly models himself on the sort of strong hand leader like Stalin. So Khrushchev is in the negative, and that story that Khrushchev's son Leonid was a traitor becomes a very important political tool, because what could you expect from a Soviet leader who denounced Stalin, in fact, in 1956? What could you expect from a leader like that whose son was a traitor? And that's what my conversation with Vyacheslav Molotov in 1981 was about. And, you know, at the time, I didn't think about Leonid at all. I didn't know anything about him being allegedly a traitor or anything. So for me, it was an absolutely shocking experience at the age of 16, which I try in my book and my life, I try to unravel and understand.
Well, you go on this kind of journey as a detective to find out about who your real grandfather was, given that you were brought up by your great grandfather Nikita Khrushchev as a grandfather, and that this extraordinary portrait of this wonderful guy who was Khrushchev's oldest son but was incredibly rebellious. He's described as a Soviet James Dean. He's an inveterate womanizer who has all kinds of beautiful women and, as a serial marrier, if indeed there really was too many authentic or official marriages. And then, of course, it all ends with you finally, with your sister, going to the area in World War II where he was a bomber pilot who was injured a couple of times, shot down a couple of times, and then became a fighter pilot and then was shot down and disappeared. And eventually, in this area, 400 miles to the west of Moscow, you find this mass grave with his name on it. And the mass grave, of course, dates to 1949, which, of course, gives a lie to the idea that somehow he was a Nazi spy when, in fact, he was a Soviet hero, who, by the way, was given medals by Stalin, was he not?
Pardon me?
Wasn't he given medals by Stalin, awarded? Wasn't Leonid given medals?
He did. He had two medals for bravery, and one was posthumous medal. And so, of course, that brings that whole idea of him being a traitor, and Stalin allegedly, in many stories, ordered to capture him from serving the Nazis, bring them back to the Kremlin, and shot him dead in the dungeons of the Kremlin. So it's all very dramatic. And, of course, that kind of becomes a problem, because if Joseph Stalin wanted to steal him and then punished him, how at the same time actually the Soviet armed forces, of which Joseph Stalin was a generalissimo, was the commander-in-chief, actually gave him a medal for bravery posthumously. So it's all, I mean, you know, once you start logical investigation, of course, it doesn't hold water. But once again, we go back to ideology. I mean, if ideologically Khrushchev needs to be a bad guy, then, you know, of course, his son would be a traitor. But it was an interesting journey, because I learned as much about Russia as I learned about my family, that, in fact, reformers are not favorite people of the Russians. I mean, genetically, once again, I use this word because we don't have free will, so to speak. It's all about the state. We do like strong leaders. We as Russians appreciate people who tell us, the Tsar, who tells us what to do. And so in this category, Khrushchev and Gorbachev, they do not fit in. It was interesting, because when Putin was talking about the annexation of Crimea in March, and, you know, how Khrushchev was responsible, he wasn't just talking about Khrushchev. He was talking about all these reformers, reform leaders who squandered away, you know, Russian greatness, and he is the uniter of lands, and they were giving things away, such as Khrushchev gave Crimea or transferred Crimea from Russia to Ukraine in 1954. Gorbachev collapsed the Soviet Union and whatnot. And Leonid is a trace of that kind of, there's a story behind it, that is, he was a human being. I mean, he was a spoiled brat. He was a very wonderful, you know how we say in America, somebody you want to have a beer with, you certainly would like to have a vodka with this guy. But at the same time, he was a bad communist, and that stood in the way of his father's relations with him, because his father really wanted him to be a communist. And that's why Leonid was never mentioned at home, because he was a bad communist, and Khrushchev was very upset and couldn't even celebrate his heroism in 1943, because he felt it was a wasted life, that Leonid was brilliant, he was talented, he could have been so much better, and yet he was not a good communist. And that really stood in the way and became then ideological and political. And that's how Molotov said to me, well, there was a rumor that he was a traitor because Khrushchev didn't talk about him. It was then understood as that Khrushchev was embarrassed of him. And what could be he embarrassed of? He must be a traitor.
Well, of course, Nina Khrushcheva, you'll be joining me. I'm hosting the UCLA Hammer Forum this coming Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. You'll be joining us to talk about your new book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, at 7:30, free and open to the public. And I'm looking forward to that. But clearly, as I mentioned in the opening, that there are cycles of repression and reform in recent Russian history, from Stalin's terror to Khrushchev's thaw to Brezhnev's re-Stalinization to Gorbachev's reform to Putin's renewed repression. And what I find extraordinary is that, and I think you make that point, that what is it about the Russian people that gravitate to despots who jail them by the millions and murder them by the millions and in exchange for which they get a few military parades. I recall in the case when I first started to get chills about Putin, it was over the submarine Kursk. You started to see Soviet era, when the families of the anguished families of the sailors, somebody comes up behind them while they're screaming at the authorities and quietly injects them with a sedative. And then, of course, Putin's handling of the Moscow theater that the Chechens took over, where they put gas, which is a sort of aerosol version of heroin, into the theater. And as collateral damage, all kinds of innocent people died. And they simply could have had this stuff called Narcan, which the police and fire carry now to revive addicts. But they didn't do it because Putin doesn't care about humanity. He didn't care about how many Russians died because that was collateral damage. And the gas that was used was a KGB or SVR state secret. So that mentality, I find it so troubling and so, but why do those guys come back all the time like a bad penny?
Well, that's, I think it's a fantastic question. I do look forward to our Hammer Forum on, I think it's on Wednesday, right? We can talk about that. But it is, I mean, that's what I call the gulag of the Russian mind, is that we don't need a barbed wire as Russians to keep us in check. We just build it our own because the state is better than anything else. I mean, there are many reasons. First of all, I think it's a very large size of Russia, which continues to be very large. It's not just the Soviet Union. It's many, many time zones, very mass of land that really hasn't changed. And usually it's very difficult to change imperial mentality when you remain of the same largesse as you ever was, because most empires stop being empires when they shed territories. It didn't happen to us. It didn't happen to us to a necessary degree. That's one. And also, kind of psychologically, in any ideology that Russia ever had, it could be, Russian Orthodoxy or communism. It's all about the commune. It's never about one human being. It's the commune knows better. Tsar knows better. The father of the nation knows better. And so that's why these fathers of the nation come back as a bad penny. And we keep coming back to them and love them. And I do call it paradox of tyranny, because the reforms never really end with any good results. So we come back to the strong hand because we believe that at least it's better the devil we know.
Right. Well, Nina, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you on Wednesday. Again, Nina Khrushcheva is professor of the Graduate School of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. Her latest book just out is The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at ianmasters.com, and you can search Background Briefing on iTunes to subscribe to the podcast. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The sharp bang out of the night, just when everything
I've written down.